Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 5th September 1979. Yesterday, we concluded our considerations with the words of the Buddha after his meditation under the Muchalinda tree, the Serpent King's tree. Now the serpent stands for the life force, amongst other things. And it represents life energy universally as well as in the individual. There are two aspects in the representation of the serpent. One is wisdom. Remember the words of Jesus, "Be wise as serpents." And the other is the serpent's tail, which stands for passion, unruly passion. And when passion has been quite transmuted, then the serpent holds his tail in his mouth. And so, that psychical energy, transformed and perfected, no longer distracts the person from proceeding towards his spiritual realization. And it helps him, in actual fact, by giving him the benefit of the full use of his psychical energy. So, after this meditation under the Muchalinda tree, he says, "Blissful is the solitude of the happy one who has learnt the law and comprehends. Blissful is unhurtfulness in the world." Harmlessness is something which India has emphasized above all things. You'll find it in the Gita too, you'll find it in all the teachings. Harmlessness towards everything. Self-restraint towards living things. Blissful is non-desire in the world. And one could add, for the world. The transcending of sense pleasures. The putting away of the conceit, "I am." And we considered the meaning involved there. This indeed is the highest bliss. Why is it the highest bliss? Because when that false fancy, "I am," a separate entity, has been fully understood, and one is free from all the limitations imposed upon one's awareness because of that illusion, then one is in harmony with the one and only "I am," which is the total reality. He next proceeds, the Buddha next proceeds, for the third period of 7 days, to the Rajayatana tree. Raja Ayatana. Ayatana, the plane or the condition, the state, which is the kingly state, the kingly tree. And here perhaps the meaning is that this inner world which one enters in deep meditation is fully lighted up for the person who has realized the supreme goal of the Brahma fairy. It is the supreme meditative state in which transcendent experiencing of totality, of the forces of life, of the cosmos, which move towards fulfillment, all are realized in his own being. Realized meaning made real, not therefore as conscious ideas or thoughts, thought forms, which are separate things, after all, imperfect little things, not as thought forms in his brain. The mind as a whole, as a totality, complete and perfect, is functioning through him. And in this connection, it is very useful to recall the Buddha's words in the Brahmajala Sutta, where he details the so-called 62 systems of philosophy in his day and points out their deficiencies. And as he points out the deficiency in those systems, with each pointing out, he ends with the words, "There are things profound, difficult to realize, hard to understand, not to be grasped by mere logic." Emphasize that very, very carefully. Not to be grasped by mere logic. Because if you grasp these, if you try to grasp these profound transcendental realities by mere logic, you will merely spin out cobwebs of thought, sometimes called philosophies, which are only illusory. They are not the reality. In fact, any sort of attempted description of things transcendent is always misleading. The Buddha himself says, and I think you will find this discourse in the third volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, that whatsoever one says about the profound states of consciousness, it is not so. It is not quite that. And of course we are reminded here of that remarkable saying of Yajnavalkya in the Upanishads, one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers, "Neti, neti, not this, not this." The transcendent, the ultimate reality, the absolute, can never be conceived of, can never be described. But it can be experienced by the supreme awakening. So now, recall those words of the Buddha, not to be grasped by mere logic, subtle, comprehensible only by the wise. Comprehensible not in a merely intellectual form, but by the whole consciousness, which implies that the whole consciousness has become these realities. All the great teachers have said similar things. "I am the truth, the way, the life." Sri Krishna says the same thing, and so forth. You see, all of them have said this. Now, these things that the Tathagata, having himself realized them by his own superknowing, puts aside the conclusions, the misleading conclusions arrived at by the different systems of philosophy which prevailed in his day, and which were not perfectly conducive to living the holy life. This meditation under the Rajayatana tree, he comes back to the Ajapala tree. And it was suggested yesterday that whilst Ajapala means a goat herd, it could also mean he who tends, nourishes the unborn, the transcendent, ever is, beginningless, endless, birthless, deathless. Now he comes back to the goatherd tree, to the Ajapala tree, and perhaps in this context we might use the other meaning of Ajapala, the goat herd, the tender, he who tends living creatures. Now, under the goat herd's tree, which perhaps is an actual tree under which he sat, under the goat, in the meditation, back when he's back again at the goat herd's tree, he is letting the impress, the transcendent impress upon his whole psychophysical being to allow to evolve how he can formulate this realization in the least misleading terms and present it verbally to those who might learn. And who could learn. Perhaps this may be a way of understanding the significance of these meditations. Now, in connection with these meditations after the enlightenment, and I would rather think during the whole process of the enlightenment, because enlightenment isn't a static something after the enlightenment is there, so to say. It is a continuously progressive thing. And it does not mean progressive in the sense of climbing higher rungs of a ladder, but intensifying in the nature of its own awareness. It's rather difficult to get this. But think of it as an intensification and a gentle relaxing of the state of awareness. Because there must always be this pulse of activity and relaxation, of rest. Just as we have an in-breathing and an out-breathing and so forth. Now, in this state, it is the state where vidya, vidya, Pali, prevails. The word vidya is usually translated as knowledge. It is an accurate translation up to a point. It is knowledge in the worldly context, in the worldly sense. The acquisition of the knowledge of facts and techniques and so forth, all of which are external to the ultimate reality. Facts, procedures, events and so forth are the expressions of the living process of transcendence. And all these undergo continuous change, transformation. Whereas vidya in the transcendent sense, that is to say in the sense in which one is aware in terms which have transcended conceptualizing and verbalizing, means direct seeing. That is the state of vidya, vidya. Not knowing in the ordinary school or university or practical worldly sense. It is direct perception. You remember yesterday, I think, I suggested that intelligence, pure intelligence, sees the truth of anything and everything immediately. without anything in between, immediate, without any intermediary. This is pure intelligence, the nous of the Greeks, the buddhi of the Indians. Here intelligence functions perfectly, and it is the crown of intellect, of the intellectual side of our nature. And avidya, as used in the scriptures, avidya, as used in the scriptures, stands for not being in that state where you are immediately aware of the truth of things, immediately perceiving. One can see the implications of this. The purity of the psyche, the utter emptiness of all obstructions to the immediate perception of truth is exemplified in the exercise of this state of vidya, of pure intelligence functioning immediately. So, there is a very deep significance to the fact that this intelligence functions in that manner. The significance is this, that awareness in the transcendent sense means that in mind and consciousness, you are that which you perceive. If you perceive a tree, in mind and consciousness, you are that tree. You will find, if you actually practice and experience, that if you can look at a tree with no imposition, or look at anything whatsoever, with no imposition of the separative self-consciousness, which makes you aware of the fact that I, the subject, a separate onlooker, am looking at that, the object, separate and different from me. So when you look, you are what you are looking at. And the essence of what you are looking at is inextricable part and parcel of your own perfected mind. You are tree-ness, rose-ness, human-ness when you look at a tree or a rose or a human being. You are that being. That is how the perfected holy ones know a person inside out immediately when he sees them, or when he hears them, or if he touches them, and so forth. All the sense functions are perfect chords of communion. These are realities. Please don't ask me to give evidence and prove it. Evidence and proving belong to the worldly context, and even if I could say a few words about it, those words would be no proof whatever. You see? Not to be grasped by mere logic. So do remember that. But whatsoever is said must of necessity have a certain unavoidable core of logic, if you use words. Otherwise, what is said will have no cohesion, no intelligible structure. And if it has no intelligible structure, it cannot be communicated. So, up to a point, there must be a core of logic if one speaks about these things. But I trust we are beginning to understand the real meaning, the significant meaning of the word vidya, knowledge, translated as knowledge. Now, if one doesn't know this, however excellent a scholar one might be, one will, in writing any commentary upon Indian wisdom or Indian religion, fall into the trap of saying that this is the teaching of the Upanishads or the Buddha, etc., that you have a piece of knowledge in the worldly sense, the worldly limited intellectual sense of the word, which is your salvation. And it doesn't involve the perfect morality, the perfect virtuousness, which is the true indispensable basis of religious fulfillment. Perhaps there's no harm in mentioning a name, because I'm not pointing a finger of scorn or accusation against him. R.E. Hume, the translator of the 12 principal Upanishads, was a magnificent piece of scholarship as such. But in his introductory essay, he falls into that trap and says that yes, this was the, or this was all that was necessary for realizing the fulfillment of your religiousness in your life. Just to know these things as a collection of so many ideas, of so many arbitrary statements. I am Brahman, I am Atma. Nothing of the sort. That's a complete misconception. It's rather sad that scholars, both East and West alike, they have fallen into that trap, because they haven't clearly understood what vidya really means. It comes from the root vid, meaning to see. But if we see wholly and completely, then there is no separate self imposing his limitations upon the seen. Therefore the seen is a total and a whole seen. And if it is a whole seeing, it is a perfect seeing, it is holy seeing. It is, to use theistic language, as God sees you. The divine eye, the third eye, functions in you as you see your neighbor. And you know him both ways. You know him as he is in his imperfect state, his incomplete state, and you also know him as the embodiment of transcendence. And it's an extraordinary thing to experience. Such a person sees you with perfect love, the love that does you no harm whatsoever, never interferes with you, never imposes itself on you. And this is the love that heals in the supreme and the divine sense. So it is important to understand the meaning of this. And it is expressed by the words in the case of the Buddha, then light arose. The Buddha is also known as the Angiras. Angiras is a term which you will find in the Rig Veda. It means the shining one, as the one who radiates from his whole being, his whole psychophysical being, radiates light. Angiras. It's said of the Buddha, and it's mentioned, I think, in the Visuddhi Magga of Buddha Gosha. And Buddha Gosha flourished roughly nine centuries after the Buddha. Also, the Buddha, just as in the Vedic writings, is understood as the Sanam Kumara, the ever virgin youth. Kumara means prince, and Kumara means the unmarried youth, the virgin youth. It is the everlasting virgin youth. Now, how and why is a perfected holy one called the everlasting virgin youth? Because virginity is perfection. It belongs to the context of the transcendent, the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. It doesn't belong to the worldly context. It has its counterpart in our worldly life. And whatsoever comes forth from that state in terms of creation, from virginity, gives rise to an immaculate conception. Unspoiled, unbesmirched by any violence, any passion, anything which separates something from the rest of the universe, anything which sunders the unity of the universe, which is the first meaning of the word sin. So, the Holy One is always Sangkumara. It's a wonderful, beautiful idea. Rather, I should say, an expression or attempted expression of a transcendent reality. Now, this meditation under the Rajayatana tree, the kingly tree, the state of the supreme, the king. We must consider the real nature of meditation. The dictionary will say meditation means musing on some particular subject, chosen subject. How do we muse? We churn up the ocean of thought, of words inside us. Now all our thoughts and all our verbal expressions are limited, they are faulty, they are very often confusing, and we are in a state of confusion, of uncertainty. Sometimes we come to a reasonable conclusion which does put us on the right lines, so to say, in relation to whatever the circumstance or the demand of the environment may be. That is rare. But usually this musing is just a state of turmoil, a state of confusion. We have to let that quieten down. We can take a profound subject. We can say, oh, I will take the Lord. If I'm of the devotee type, I'll say, the one I worship, and meditate on him, or her, as the case may be. It may be the Mother Goddess. Why not? You see? That I'll meditate upon her. But what does that meditation amount to? Have you ever attempted it? Tried it out. Try it out again and again. Don't reject anything. Try out all these things with an open mind, and then find out for yourself what happens inside your own awareness. So, if we take a profound subject or a holy ideal person, the Christ, the Buddha, Zarathustra, Krishna, the incarnate Lord, or any such thing, see what happens when you muse upon it. if you can go about it the right way, you will find after a time that your own intelligence will tell you, it's not quite like this, it's not quite like this. And when your inner intelligence tells you that, it will tell it to you compassionately. It won't tell it to you in a way which makes you feel that, oh, I am being a fool. Perhaps one could be aware, yes, I am foolish, in a very quiet, sensible way, without self-hate. This is very important, because any such thing like self-hate defeats any attempt at meditation in the true sense. Going through those stages, the turmoil of the flow of discursive thought, of continuous mental chatter, of turmoil, of confusion in the mind, quietens down. And at the same time, all the sense functions also become pacified, made peaceful. Then they begin to function much more alertly. And they function in the process of meditation. Because the stuff of meditation in this sense, this limited sense of musing, is what has come into your brain through the avenues of sense during your lifetime. You see? So the sense functions become pacified. They remain active, mind you, but they are now active in the tamed and the trained way. Blessed are the meek. The meaning of the word meek. Tamed and trained. And the training comes from within, not from without. It could be stimulated from without by another person telling you of his own experience and what he has discovered and learned and so forth. But then what he says is merely being interpreted by you in accord with your own conditioning. So he might as well have not said it. It is from within. If the stimulus is of the right sort from the other person, if he is capable enough, if he is wise enough to give you the right stimulus, then from within yourself will emerge a truer and truer understanding. Desiderare means to look away from the light. Consider. If you consider, then you are looking at the light within and let it come. And you can't consider in the true sense unless all your psychophysical being is peaceful and quiet. It is in that state that consideration, true consideration, can emerge. As you proceed that way, remember always that the fundamental basis has to be the living of the moralities. No mistake about it. The commandments, the advices, use what word you like. See, it has to be that. As you proceed this way, you will discover that the whole flow of discursive thought, which is turbulent, gradually becomes peaceful until there is the first experience of the real silence. Because when the thought process has become silent, all disturbance, both external, from external sources, and from within oneself, cease to affect you. It's not that they won't recur again when you have finished with what you call the period of meditation. That may happen again. But in the real meditation, all that begins to quieten down. And as the Buddha put it, when you reach a deeper and a deeper state intensity of pure awareness, all your past sorrow and your past pleasure, delight, they all quieten down and disappear as such. Now your awareness is functioning in a state undisturbed by the conflict of the duals, the opposites. When that conflict of the duals ceases, you have transcended each dual. If you transcend any one of the duals, the other one also disappears. It's an extraordinary thing to realize. And it's a wonderful thing. I don't quite like to use the word hope in this context, but it is a ground for hope. And not only is it a ground for hope in the profound true sense, hoping for oneself or for one's friends or anybody like that, but it also gives you the ground for true faith. Now you don't have merely to believe. You know this is so. Of course it is so. There's no question about it. And there is the strength derived from the peace and quietness of such vision and such realization. This is the stage which in the Buddhist teachings is called the fourth jhana. Jhana is from dhyana, meaning attentiveness, paying attention. Attentiveness, you may remember, your power of attentiveness, I said yesterday, is your great instrument of salvation. That is to say, salvation in the sense of making you whole, complete, healthy, the true Son of Man at last, come to fruition, holy. And that is the meaning of the holy, one meaning at least of the holy. Now, as the intensity of awareness grows and grows, and please note, I use the term intensity of awareness, I don't use the term planes of consciousness. One can't use that term, or the rung, climbing the rungs of a ladder, because those are all far too worldly and concrete and separative. But this state of awareness increases in intensity. That is to say, it begins to glow and glow until it becomes a tremendous light which absolutely sort of spreads throughout the universe. You know, this idea of glowing is an extraordinary thing. The bush which burns without being consumed. You know about that from the Old Testament. But in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you will find this extraordinary sentence. Nothing whatsoever consumes it. It consumes nothing whatsoever. Now this, there is a lovely analogy in our physical, in our everyday world, in terms of music. You know how a truly great composer, a Bach or a Beethoven or a Mozart or a Brahms, will present the first subject, as we call it, as a theme, then comes the bridge, the second subject, the third subject, and then there, that is the exposition, and then the themes are taken up and worked up. Now notice what happens when those themes are worked up. They begin to get more and more intense until they absolutely glow with sheer beauty. The utter beauty of sound. the beauty of sound, which transcends sound and is taken up into the supreme silence. This is an extraordinary thing. Sound in the ordinary way impinges upon us. But when that sound is brought to the state of perfection, it has ceased to impinge, to hurt you almost. You are taken up into that silence which can take in the whole thing, and there is unbroken peace, unbroken holiness present. That's one of the most marvelous things about Western music that I know of. It really is wonderful. So, a similar sort of thing happens in terms of your state of consciousness, your state of awareness. Now remember, at this point, discriminative consciousness has disappeared. Discriminative consciousness separates. This does not mean, therefore, that when that has disappeared, there is no discernment. In an extraordinary way, there is present also discernment. And as this state of awareness gets more and more glowing, what happens is that you are now in touch with the archetypal universal forms of expression of the primordial creative energy. We human beings can contact only certain of these archetypal forms. We are limited by the fact that this is a psychophysical organism, and as long as it lives, it can enter, assuming all the rest has proceeded in the right way, we can enter into these extraordinary, profound states of consciousness in which we touch divinity to the extent that divinity can be touched by a human structure. The Son of Man, the Son of Mind, has become the Son of God. The Manushya Putra is now changed into the Brahma Putra, but he is still Putra, Son of. The supreme mystery remains the everlasting mystery, marvelous, wonderful, beyond description. It will take you into itself, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead sort of idea, you see. It will take you into itself, but for that to happen, your eyes are shut, your ears don't hear, your tongue doesn't taste, your thought process is completely still in that supreme silence. Now, as one enters into that state where you are in touch with the universal archetypal forces which are spoken of in the Buddhist texts as entering upon the infinity of Akasha and of Vijnana, of space-time, of life consciousness, entering into the infinity of those. Now you know, we have this, some of the systems of meditation laid down, and in Buddhism, what are called the Brahma Viharas. And one is told, suffuse with metta, loving kindness, your teacher, yourself, note carefully, yourself, so that there is not a vestige of self-hate within you. Suffuse your near ones, but not in the early stages, not someone of whom you are particularly fond, and for beginners, not anyone of the opposite sex. It sounds funny, but it's quite serious. It has tremendous consequences. So beware of that. That will come later on and you'll be all right. You'll be good. Now, and you remember the other day, I said, what do you mean by suffusing the other person? What do you do? In the worldly state, unable to enter into this silence, the first great silence into which you enter, in the worldly state, you merely go through a verbal ritual. You may say, oh, may all beings in the East be happy, etc., etc. All right, say it. Does that make all beings in the world, in the East, happy? Or somebody is suffering from something particular. What is one's own response to that? Oh, I pray that he will be relieved of his rheumatism or this or the pimple on his nose or whatever it is. No. That's all futile and it's impotent. People say, but surely you don't know what you're talking about. When so and so was desperately ill, I prayed with all my heart to God and God answered the prayer and that person got well. All right. There perhaps was some effect of this person's intensity of longing for the other person's health, well-being. May have been something. But don't forget that in so many cases, nothing happens. Nothing happens. The thing doesn't work. Take the condition of war. I prayed to God that my brother or father be saved. He was killed on the battlefield, not saved. And that absolutely breaks one's trust in the conventional expressions of our faith. But now, when you are in this state of awareness, at home in the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana, if in that state, yourself being completely at peace, completely whole and holy, are the instrument, the living apparatus through which transcendent energies can flow. You have become the nexus, the focus point into which transcendence enters and flows out, without the brain knowing anything about it. Now, if in this state you call to mind the name and or the appearance of any particular person and just hold that in your consciousness, an effect will undoubtedly take place. But not an effect according to your desire, according to the form which you give to it. May so-and-so, who is so beautiful, be able to get rid of that scar on her cheek. Not that sort of thing at all. Just let be, let transcendence work. And the working of transcendence, whatsoever it may be in outward expression, ultimately will be the right thing, the supreme thing, the perfect thing. Then oneself is no longer in conflict with transcendence. Have you ever taken a dagger or a sword and slashed away at the air intending to slay it? You see, it's like that. So now, in this state, the Brahma Viharic kind of technique, as verbally presented, works. And it really is, it is a real potency. So when you call up that person by name, and the name is such an important thing, or by visualizing that person in front of you and wishing nothing whatsoever, this energy is at work because you have suffused that being in the true sense. There is no other suffusion possible. Right. We go on to the deeps of meditation, the deepest depths. You know how you move with a further intensification of that red hot glow to a white hot heat. There's a complete radiance, the complete light which goes flows out of that state of awareness, and you realize the no thing. It's usually translated as nothing. N-O-T-H-I-N-G. But spell it this way: N-O hyphen T-H-I-N-G. What is the significance? Nothing separate. Nothing which is not part of the universal totality. And by the word universe in this context, I don't mean merely the material cosmos that astronomers or you or I can see and so forth. I mean the one total reality whatsoever it may be. See? You realize the no thing. In other words, you are getting into touch with this primordial creative energy, which is everlastingly in action in eternity. The context is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, and not the finite, the mortal. Bear in mind the absolute necessity of perfect morality in oneself, because when you let loose such forces, these great archetypal forces, which are represented in the names of the archangels and the gods and all the rest of it, you see, then you are, if you are not doing it rightly, if there is any imperfection in oneself, you are playing with fire. And it will be like a fire of hell. But if there is the perfect basis, the psychophysical constitution will stand the strain, will stand the voltage, shall I use that sort of language. You can't put 1,000 volts through a 240-volt bulb. You'll have to go and buy a new bulb at once. You see, it's like that. And this is a very serious matter. It breaks the person, and that breaking is often shown in the sort of accounts we have, for instance, in the Hindu Puranas, of the great sage, the Holy One, reaching into tremendous depths of consciousness and releasing tremendous powers, so that the gods themselves begin to quake and seek a way of getting this man away from his meditations, his austerities as they are called. So they send an alluring apsara, a damsel, you see, who is just irresistible. And the unfortunate sage happens to perhaps just begin to wink and open an eyelid or something, and the trouble has taken place, and the gods are safe as gods. Think again of Siegfried the Fearless. that in the ring of the Nibelungen. There's a wonderful myth, you know. It's a wonderful myth. Something like that happens. And back you come to the state of confusion, turmoil. But once this no thing is realized, then there is no going backwards. Because you are reduced to your own no thingness, which means there is no self-esteem, no self-evaluation, no selfness whatsoever. It is all completely burnt out of you. And you remember the other day we considered the meaning of the word Purusha. It means he in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. And the final condition is the one in which you are entirely taken up into and unseverable part of this primordial creative energy at work, the great pulse of creation. You are the instrument of that creative pulse. Remember when Moses asked Yahweh Elohim, if the Israelites ask me, who hath sent you? Say unto them, Ehye Asher Ehye, I am that I am, the one total absolute. This state of unity with the absolute is the state which gives you the power, the authority, the mandate. And it all comes from within yourself, the starting point, the so-called separate self, which has transcendence embodied in it. And that embodied transcendence, having become completely at one with the total transcendence, gives you that divine authority to teach.